The epitaph I have chosen for Elijah this morning is a quotation from his own lips. "I have had enough, Lord. Take my life." Is that amazing or what? Here's one of the greatest miracle workers in history. A man who has just defeated 850 prophets of Baal and Asherah. A man who, the first time in history, raised someone from the dead. A man who stopped the rain for 3.5 years and then brought the rain again through his own prayers and the power of God. And within the space of a few hours from his great victory on Mount Carmel, he is expressing a death wish. Can you believe that? Well, you can if you have ever experienced depression. This message today is for troubled Christians, those who feel under the gun, those who think they're standing all alone, those who wonder why God is silent, those who were once being used significantly but now feel like they've been put on a shelf, or those who simply lack joy in their Christian experience. This is a message for you. On the other hand, if you're someone who has it all together and you've never felt down and you never throw pity parties, you can be excused. Unless, of course, you want to stay around and try to understand your wife or children or friends, because they have probably experienced much the same thing that Elijah had. And I believe God can speak through Elijah this morning and help all of us. I am stating the obvious when I say that spiritual victory is hard to attain and even harder to maintain. Sometimes we are most vulnerable to depression or feeling down after we've experienced a great spiritual victory. We have countless biblical examples of individuals who accomplished great things for God and then crashed and burned. You think of Moses and Samson and David and Solomon and Jonah and Jeremiah and Peter and Elijah. Elijah's roller coaster ride is one of the classics of biblical literature. And what we discover in our scripture text today is that Elijah goes from the heights of Mount Carmel, where he achieved phenomenal success, to the wilderness of Horeb, where he experiences deep spiritual and emotional depression. 2 weeks ago, in our study of chapter 18, we found Elijah on Mount Carmel, where he took on King Ahab of Israel, the religion of Baal, 850 prophets of Baal and Asherah, and he took on a huge crowd of antagonistic Israelites. And he won a dramatic victory. He championed the truth. He challenged the faint-hearted. He fought against the forces of darkness. He demonstrated great faith in God. He exercised great power in prayer. And he came through it all triumphant. I want us to read the tail end of that story in chapter 18, beginning in verse 41. "And Elijah said to Ahab, 'Go eat and drink, for there is the sound of a heavy rain.' So Ahab went off to eat and drink, but Elijah climbed to the top of Carmel, bent down to the ground, and put his face between his knees. 'Go and look toward the sea,' he told his servant. And he went up and looked. 'There's nothing there,' he said. 7 times Elijah said, 'Go back.' The 7th time the servant reported, 'A cloud as small as a man's hand is rising from the sea.' So Elijah said, 'Go and tell Ahab, hitch up your chariot and go down before the rain stops you.' Meanwhile, the sky grew black with clouds, the wind rose, a heavy rain came on, and Ahab rode off to Jezreel. The power of the Lord came upon Elijah, and tucking his cloak into his belt, he ran ahead of Ahab all the way to Jezreel." I have a hunch that Elijah believes that Ahab has had a change of heart. Like all the people who are screaming, the Lord, He is God. The Lord, He is God. So Elijah shows compassion on Ahab, encouraging him to get some refreshment before he heads home to Jezreel. He also informs Ahab, the Lord is bringing the drought to an end, for there is the sound of a heavy rain. Now, he heard that sound not with his physical ears, but with his ears of faith. So sure is he that God is going to keep his promise that he speaks of the storm as though it is already on its way. Elijah himself climbs to the peak of Mount Carmel and he bows down before God in prayer. Six times he prays. Six times he sends his servant with to no avail to look for a cloud. But on the seventh time, God comes through for Elijah. A small cloud forms on the horizon of the Mediterranean, and the wind picks up and a storm develops, all because of the humble, earnest, and persistent prayer of one man. So exhilarating is this experience for Elijah. He runs all the way back to Jezreel, a distance of approximately 18 miles. God even enables him to outrun the chariot of Ahab. It is Elijah's greatest day. Perhaps never since the time of Moses has God used one man in such a remarkable way as he has just used Elijah. To go from Carmel to Jezreel involves the descent of about 1,400 feet in elevation. But Elijah doesn't stop there. He keeps descending, both physically and emotionally, until he finds himself 300 miles to the south in the wilderness of Horeb. Let's read the first 10 verses of chapter 19. Now, Ahab told Jezebel everything Elijah had done and how he had killed all the prophets with the sword. So Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah to say, "May the gods deal with me, be it ever so severely, if by this time tomorrow I do not make your life like that of one of them." Elijah was afraid and ran for his life. When he came to Beersheba in Judah, he left his servant there while he himself went a day's journey into the desert. He came to a broom tree, sat down under it, and prayed that he might die. "I have had enough, Lord," he said. "Take my life. I am no better than my ancestors." Then he lay down under the tree and fell asleep. All at once, an angel touched him and said, "Get up and eat." He looked around, and there by his head was a cake of bread baked over hot coals and a jar of water. He ate and drank and then lay down again. The angel of the Lord came back a second time and touched him and said, "Get up and eat, for the journey is too much for you." So he got up and ate and drank. Strengthened by that food, he traveled 40 days and 40 nights until he reached Horeb, the mountain of God. There he went into a cave and spent the night. And the word of the Lord came to him, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" He replied, "I have been very zealous for the Lord God Almighty. The Israelites have rejected your covenant, broken down your altars, and put your prophets to death with the sword. I am the only one left, and now they are trying to kill me too." Elijah is clinically depressed. I don't think there's any doubt about that. It all starts as Elijah and Ahab reach Jezreel. This is the location of the king's summer home, where Jezebel apparently remained during the battle up on Mount Carmel. As soon as Ahab gets home, he starts to tell Jezebel about all that has happened up on the mountain. Perhaps he is hopeful that she too will be impressed by the power of God that he saw up on that mountain. Perhaps she will reject her foreign gods and turn in faith to Yahweh. But any hopes or illusions that she might change her heart are quickly dashed as soon as Ahab tells her that the 450 prophets of Baal have all been put to death by Elijah. Jezebel is livid, and she summons all the evil passion in her heart as she sends a message to Elijah that she intends to execute him in the same way that he executed the prophets of Baal. But you might ask, why doesn't Jezebel just kill him on the spot? He's right there in Jezreel. Why does she threaten to kill him on the next day? This is a cunning woman. I think she realizes that if she puts the prophet to death, the people won't stand for that because he has just performed an amazing miracle in front of their eyes. But if she threatens him and he runs, then she has accomplished the same thing. She's gotten rid of Elijah without turning him into a martyr. Unfortunately, Elijah plays right into her hand. Verse 3 says, Elijah was afraid and ran for his life. Single-handedly, this prophet took on 850 wicked prophets and won a great victory. And one wicked woman says, boo, and he crashes. Lord, I've had it. I'm turning in my prophet's badge. How do you account for such an amazing turnaround? Depression is the answer. And if you do not understand this, it's only because you have never experienced it. I want to talk about some of the circumstances that contribute to depression, almost all of which are evident in Elijah's life. First, the unsustainability of spiritual highs. My spell checker tells me unsustainability is not a word, but if it isn't, it should be. What I am suggesting here is that when you have a spiritual high, it's impossible to maintain that indefinitely. When you go to the mountain, you eventually have to come back down. Teenagers at camp or on a mission trip can certainly witness to this. They come home rededicated and pumped and ready to take their campus for Christ. And then their little brother or sister does or says something just like they did before camp. And all of a sudden they lose their sanctification and get back into their old habit patterns. Or couples go to a marriage conference. I'm sure many of you have been there. And they tell you to write down all the wonderful things about your spouse. You know, they always do this. So you write those down and you tell your spouse how wonderful she is or he is. And then on Friday night you have a date and everything is great. But then on Sunday morning, she's late getting ready for church like always. And he cuts somebody off on Manchester Road. And by the time they get to church on Sunday morning, they're at each other's throats just like they were before. You know, I don't think this fact of the unsustainability of spiritual highs is an argument against trying to reach spiritual highs, but it's probably a good argument for being realistic about them when we get there. If we recognize that life cannot be a great continual love fest with God and with other people, then perhaps we'll be better prepared to handle the valleys that always come after the mountaintop experiences. I suspect Elijah is pretty unrealistic about life as he leaves Mount Carmel. He believes that the long-awaited arrival, revival has finally arrived. The people are worshiping God alone, and even Ahab has shown some signs of spiritual life in him. Elijah's floating on air. He will soon be doing Bible studies in the king's palace. He'll be right in the thick of the Reformation, and people will be taking pilgrimages down to Jerusalem. But unfortunately, a lot of what he sees is smoke and mirrors. Certainly, Ahab turns out to be a fair-weather penitent, a milquetoast of a man, who is totally dominated by his evil wife. The spiritual high Elijah experienced on Mount Carmel is simply unsustainable. Even when God has given us great victories, there are no guarantees that life will be smooth sailing afterwards. This is related also to the second circumstance that leads to depression, and that is disappointment in God. It's been my experience that a lot of depression is the direct result of unfulfilled expectations. Some people seem to go through life with greater expectations than can possibly be realized with their spouse or their kids or their friends or even their church. And they end up invariably being disappointed when those expectations are not fulfilled. Ultimately, they tend to transfer these disappointments to God. They may not say it, but they think it. God, why didn't you come through for me? I wouldn't be a bit surprised if this isn't part of Elijah's problem. Then there is severe trial, often resulting in fear and anger. Elijah's life is being threatened by Jezebel. And Jezebel is not just any woman. She is a wicked woman whose reputation for godlessness and violence is unprecedented. Her threats are not idle threats. And when she puts out a contract on Elijah's life, he goes into a spiritual tailspin. This can happen to us too, you know. And doesn't necessarily take a contract on our lives. It may be the loss of a job or severe illness or betrayal by a friend or a death in the family or of a close friend or maybe something much less catastrophic, perhaps financial pressures or the stress of daily living or even poor self-esteem. Fear frequently accompanies severe trial, and so does anger. We clearly see the fear in Elijah, but the anger is not quite so obvious. I believe it's there too, though. I think he's angry at God, and the death wish that he expresses is evidence of that anger. He doesn't really want to die, but it's his way of telling God that he didn't deserve what he received. Anger almost always accompanies fear. If you know someone who is extremely angry, you probably know someone who is also very fearful. Why? Because when we're fearful, we feel helpless. And when we feel helpless, we lash out at those around us as a defensive mechanism to protect what little is left of us. And these are common symptoms of depression. In fact, psychologists describe depression as a temper tantrum turned inward. And then we see in Elijah's life physical and emotional exhaustion. Elijah has just run a marathon. And even though he ran it in the power of the Spirit of God, it left his body depleted. In addition, he has gone through an extremely emotional experience up on top of Mount Carmel. And he has probably been awake for at least 36 hours straight, perhaps even longer. I think it would be a miracle if he didn't suffer a breakdown. We simply must realize that everyone, even godly people, even godly leaders, are subject to the laws of nature. Our physical and emotional condition does affect our spiritual life. And we dare not ignore that. Too little sleep, too little exercise, the wrong kind of diet, the change of life, irregularity, pressure on the job, all of these things can produce depression or even more serious emotional illnesses. They can take us from the mountaintop to the valley in no time at all. We are not made to run full bore over a long period of time. Adrenaline pumps in our bodies to enable us to do some amazing things over a short period of time, but if we keep that up, we're going to eventually pay a price. For years while pastoring in Wichita, I woke up every Monday morning with a splitting headache and couldn't get out of bed until noon. The amount of nervous energy and adrenaline that I expended preparing sermons up until Saturday evening, delivering several of them on Sunday morning, again on Sunday night, made it inevitable that I would crash on Monday. Eventually, I got smart and realized that if Monday was going to be such a bad day, I would go to work on Monday and ruin the day at work instead of ruining my day off. And I switched my day off till Saturday. And interestingly, the headaches pretty much stopped because I had balanced my week better and the adrenaline drop-off didn't hit me so hard. Then we see social isolation with Elijah. It says in verse 3 that when he came to Beersheba in Judah, he left his servant there while he himself went a day's journey into the desert and then, of course, on down to Sinai. Elijah was never a social butterfly, to be sure, but here we find him going it totally alone. This was probably not a wise decision. We all have a tendency to isolate ourselves from other people when we're depressed, but that's probably the last thing we ought to do. It's when we feel tempted and troubled and down that we need other people. And isolation only contributes to the feelings of depression. I received several emails the week before Mother's Day from women who always experience depression as Mother's Day approaches. One because she is not a mother but wanted to be, and the other because she had lost a child and Mother's Day reminded her so much of that. And both women asked me if it was okay if they didn't come to church that Sunday. Of course, it was okay for them to miss church, but I told them both that might not be the best thing to do. I told them that we would be praying not only for the mothers that day, but for those who wanted to be mothers and couldn't be, and for those who had lost their mothers, and for those who had lost children. I told them there'd be nothing in the sermon that would bring more pain into their lives. And at least one of those women came that morning. She came up to me afterwards and said she was glad that she had. Then we see inaccurate theological perspectives. Don't let anyone tell you that theology is unrelated to life. Our beliefs about God greatly affect our emotional health. You show me someone who doesn't believe in the sovereignty of God, and I'll show you someone who doesn't know peace in his or her life. You show me someone who doesn't understand the fatherhood of God, and I'll show you someone who has poor self-esteem. Elijah demonstrates for us how inaccurate theological perspectives can contribute to depression. He has forgotten who God is, and it didn't take him long to forget. I personally suffer from short-term memory loss due to a brain injury I sustained about 9 years ago. I can cope with it by taking lots of notes, and as long as I don't forget where I put the notes. But frankly, there's a much more dangerous kind of memory loss, short-term and long-term, that many Christians suffer from, and that is loss of memory of God's work in their lives. Elijah knows the history of Israel. Elijah knows the faithfulness of God to his people. Elijah knows how God has worked in his own life very recently. Just days before he crashes and burns, he has witnessed God accomplish one of the most amazing miracles in all of human history. But then he forgets it all in a matter of a few hours. And the result is depression. I'd like to mention one other cause of depression, and that is brain chemistry. I don't have any evidence that Elijah had this particular problem. Frankly, I don't know. But I mention it anyway because there are people who are troubled by depression, not because of their difficult circumstances, as with Elijah, but because they have an imbalance in their brain chemistry. Situational depression can generally be improved by changing the situation. But chemical depression can only be corrected by medicine. That medication is a gift from God. And I don't believe anyone should feel guilty about taking that medication if it is medically indicated. My heart goes out especially to those who suffer from medical depression because they can't solve their problem by getting more sleep or getting going on a better diet or getting exercise or even trusting God more, though these actions may help a little bit. If they are not treated medically, then they are helplessly trapped in a pit of depression. And sometimes that can even be fatal. I've known spiritual leaders who have committed suicide because of depression. If you have a loved one that you think might be medically depressed, I would urge you to read up all you can about depression and then get that person to a doctor. I've been taking a class on Tuesday nights taught by Dar and Mary Louise Walker, a 12-week class on depression and other kinds of mental illnesses. If you have a family member or even a close friend who suffers from one of these illnesses, I would urge you to take that class the next time it is offered. Let's move now to examine some of the reactions that often accompany depression. And once again, we see these reactions in the life of Elijah. First is flight. Elijah runs for his life. First he runs to Beersheba, then he runs into the desert, and finally he runs all the way to Mount Horeb, which is another term for Mount Sinai. Mount Sinai is not the end of the world, but you can see the end of the world from Mount Sinai. It is the perfect place to go if you want to get away from everyone or even animals, because there's almost nothing that lives in the Sinai desert. But it's not a good place to go to get over depression. Where do you flee to when you're feeling down or depressed? Some retreat to the world of alcohol or drugs or gambling. Some look for new pastures, a new location, a new job, maybe even a new spouse. Others go out and spend money. You know the adage, when the going gets tough, the tough go shopping. This is how some people deal with depression. The bottom line is, when we get discouraged, we run away from our failures and deaden the pain with some cheap anesthetic. But it's a vicious cycle, because when we go to the wrong places, the depression just gets worse. Then we see in Elijah loss of perspective. You know, a depressed person cannot think straight. He's not logical. Generally, you cannot argue a person out of depression. Consider Elijah as a case in point. Who were these gods by whom Jezebel swore that she was going to kill him? Aren't they the very ones that he has shown up on Mount Carmel? These gods? And didn't Yahweh vindicate himself before these gods? At the same time, Elijah is feeling this terribly down and looking through the wrong end of the binoculars. Depression distorts everything. Small problems appear huge. Simple difficulties look terribly complex. Temporary struggles appear endless. We have difficulty seeing the light at the end of the tunnel, and when we see it, we think it's a train coming at us. And then we see excessive sleep as one of the results of depression. Depressed people sleep a lot, like all the time. Notice that Elijah sleeps in verse 5, and again in verse 6, and again in verse 9. His body craves sleep, and it needs sleep, and that's okay. God not only does not rebuke him for sleeping, he actually facilitates Elijah's sleep. Let me say to you that there are times when the most spiritual thing you can do is go to bed and sleep for 10, 12, or 14 hours. Now, if that's constant, then you need to see a doctor. But sometimes that's what we need to do. Then we see self-pity on Elijah's part. Look again at his response to God's question. What are you doing here? And Elijah replies, I am the only one who is faithful. The people have faked repentance. Jezebel still reigns. Ahab is a wimp. And I alone am left. Whenever we go through deep waters, we are often tempted to engage in self-pity. We rehearse for God all that we have done for him, and we compare ourselves to people that are more wicked than we are, and then we play the martyr's game, sometimes even to the point of suicidal thoughts. I mentioned these factors that lead to depression and these reactions that typically accompany depression so that we can be more aware in diagnosing it and more sympathetic and empathetic with people who suffer from it. I also want to share a bit with you about my own personal journey. Other than the Blue Mondays that I spoke of earlier, I had never experienced depression until I was 39 years old. Late that summer, 1983, I started experiencing things that I had never experienced before. I became extremely tired. I would come home from work at noon, have some lunch and lie down on the couch, and 2 hours later I could hardly drag myself back to work, and that is extremely unusual for me. I found it difficult to do anything but what was absolutely necessary. I lost all interest in intimacy. I became unusually irritable with people around me. And after a month or two, I wised up and went to see a professional counselor. After 20 minutes, the counselor said to me, "You're clinically depressed." I was shocked. In fact, I said to him, "That's impossible. I've never been depressed a day in my life." And he told me all the symptoms which I had. And then he told me the causes of it in my life. He mentioned, for example, that there were several vacancies on our staff and I was working 75 hours a week. I had gained about 20 pounds that year. You know, that happens when you're about ready to turn 40 years old. My wife was pregnant for the first time after 19 years of marriage. And while that was very exciting, it also introduced a lot of stress in our lives. And the counselor prescribed some pretty radical treatment. He said, "I want you to leave tomorrow and go to..." I'm just going to get through this. It's hard to talk about depression. He said, "I want you to go to Colorado and stay at a retreat center for a week. I'll tell the elders that you need to go." And then he said, "I want you to join a health club and start getting exercise at least 3 times a week. I want you to go on a diet and lose some weight. I want you to cut your hours at work." And I did all those things, and within 6 weeks, the depression was gone. I was fortunate. My depression was situational. And with situational depression, as I noted earlier, you can often correct it by changing the situation. Usually medication is not needed, but one has to be willing to make hard changes to deal with it. I experienced one other severe period of depression. That was 10 years later, in 1993, after an automobile accident. This time it lasted about 5 months. And again, was mostly situational. I was struggling to cope with the physical and emotional effects of that accident. I share my own personal story with you today to encourage those in the congregation who may suffer from depression to seek help. And then to say to the rest of you, be patient with them and help them through it. It's possible to cope with depression. It's not possible just to survive, but even to thrive. And that brings us to the most encouraging part of our story today, and that is that God refuses to abandon Elijah. Instead, he does 3 specific things to convince Elijah of his presence and his concern. First, he sends a ministering angel to provide for his physical needs. The angel touches him while he's sleeping and says, "Get up and eat. You need some nourishment." He did it a second time. And you know, this strikes me. Why would God do this if Elijah is cowering in fear and running away from God after all God has done for him? Why does God provide so solicitously for him and even perform a miracle for him? I wouldn't, at least not until I experienced my own depression. And I really think that's why God allowed me to go through it. Because if you haven't been through it, you have no idea. But God knows. And so God showed his concern to him. You know, there may be times when you are out of God's will, like Elijah was. But you are never out of God's concern. God delivers to Elijah no critical speeches, no words of reproach, no threats of dismissal, only sleep and food and kindly thoughtfulness for the long journey ahead. That's the kind of God we worship. Perhaps there is someone here this morning who feels totally wiped out because of troubles that have piled up in your life, or because you are overpowered by some temptation. You have failed. You feel full of shame. You're feeling worthless. You just want to hide. You don't even want to come to church any morning, and the only reason you're here today is out of force of habit, or maybe you had a responsibility here today. Please believe that you are not forgotten by God. He loves you, and he wants to restore the years that the locust has eaten. You may not feel his love. You may believe you have forfeited it. And you may imagine that you are hopelessly estranged from God, but you are not. Take heart. God loves you. And I, for one, believe he will do the same thing for you today that he did for Elijah 2,500 years ago. He did it for me. That angel may come in the form of a friend or a person to come alongside of you, but God will provide. Secondly, God gently challenges Elijah to examine his behavior. Elijah is now hiding in a cave in the rugged wilderness of the Sinai Desert. Actually, the Hebrew says he was hiding in the cave. What cave on Mount Sinai could be called the cave? I think it's the cave God put Moses in 500 years before, as Moses was put in the cleft of the rock, and then God came by and demonstrated his glory to Moses. He's going to do the same thing for Elijah. God doesn't say to Elijah, "You ungrateful bum, look what I did for you up on Mount Carmel. Now quit your pity party, get your rear in gear, get back into the battle." God speaks gently to him and just says, "Elijah, what are you doing here?" Most importantly, God reveals himself to Elijah in a unique way. Quickly, let's read beginning in verse 11. The Lord said, "Go out and stand on the mountain in the presence of the Lord, for the Lord is about to pass by." Then a great and powerful wind tore the mountains apart and shattered the rocks before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. After the wind, there was an earthquake, but the Lord was not in the earthquake. After the earthquake came a fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire came a gentle whisper. Then a voice said to him, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" And he replied, "I have been very zealous for the Lord God Almighty. The Israelites have rejected your covenant, broke down your altars, and put your prophets to death with the sword. I am the only one left, and now they are trying to kill me too." Because of Elijah's apparent loss of confidence in God, the Lord graciously gives him essentially the same incredible experience that Moses had of him. And in quick succession, Elijah experiences these great phenomena of nature, and God says, "I'm not revealing myself through those things to you. I'm just revealing myself through a still, small voice." What's going on here? I believe God is saying to Elijah, "Elijah, you had no trouble trusting me up on Mount Carmel when the battle was hot and I was performing great and mighty miracles. But I don't always or even usually operate that way. I usually work gently, softly, and in an unperceived manner. But still, you must not doubt my presence." We at times tend to think that if dramatic things aren't happening, if the church isn't growing, and if we're not seeing signs and wonders, that God somehow isn't there. But he is. He is also present in our trials. He's present when we face temptation. He He's present when we are lonely and depressed. The problem is we aren't often willing to be quiet enough to hear him. Quiet and solitude are two rare experiences for the average American Christian. Some people turn on the TV in the morning and leave it on all day. The minute they get in the car, the radio starts blasting. We even have music on the telephone when we're waiting for someone to answer. Martin Kelsey wrote, "Most modern life is a studied attempt to avoid ever being alone." Yet constantly in both the Old Testament and New Testament, the advantages of quiet and solitude before God are conveyed to us. Listen to a couple of verses from Psalm 46. "God is our refuge and strength, an ever-present help in trouble. Therefore, we will not fear, though the earth give way and the mountains fall into the heart of the sea, though its waters roar and foam and the mountains quake with their surging. Be still and know that I am God." Be still and know that I am God. After revealing himself to Elijah, God recommissions him. This is a beautiful thing. We don't have time to go into it, but he gives him a fresh call to service, and then he provides companionship. He appoints Elisha, not to take his place, but to be his partner in ministry, eventually to take his place, but to be there for him. I've experienced someone like that in my life. I'm sure that you have too. That's God's way of saying, "I love you and I care for you." And then God assures Elijah that he is not alone. Twice he had complained, "I am the only one left." And God says that it's not true. There are 7,000 others who have not bowed the knee to Baal. I close with four brief principles to ponder. Number one, Christians, even those who are effective and godly leaders, are not immune to depression, either situational or chemical. Depression is a cancer of the soul. And just like physical cancer, it can hit the old or the young, the rich or the poor, the godly or the ungodly. If you've never experienced it, be grateful. But please be patient with those who have. Number two, God expects us to get sufficient rest, relaxation, and nutrition to handle life's challenges over the long haul and to seek medical help if it is needed. If you start now to pay attention to these things, it is less likely that you will ever suffer depression. If you're in depression now, participate in your own recovery by dealing with these issues. Thirdly, it is okay to express negative feelings, and all of us need a safe, non-judgmental place in which to do it. I find it instructive that twice God here says to Elijah, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" And even though God doesn't get a very satisfactory answer either time, he doesn't rebuke Elijah and he doesn't reject him. He doesn't even try to fix him. He just speaks to him quietly. He lets him sleep. He shows him his glory. And when he is ready, he gives him another chance. Finally, you are never alone. God is there, and so are others. Rudyard Kipling wrote that if we treat triumph and disaster, those two impostors, the same, then we are on our way to becoming men. We do this by getting our eyes off of ourselves and focusing them on God, who loved us enough to send his own son to us, who loves us unconditionally, and by whose grace we will eventually overcome if we do not grow weary and become faint. Let's pray.